20, Ford had 90% of the low-priced car market and was responsible for 54% of the total automotive manufacturing output in the country. Ford's position seemed to be invincible. Yet by May 1927, technical advances at General Motors and other automotive companies had forced Henry Ford to take the drastic step of shutting down his main plant for an entire year to retool for new designs. Today, Ford is still a world leader in automobile production and quality, but it has never regained its pre-1927 position in the industry. Somebody at Ford saw the changes coming in the 1920s. An engineer who came up with a new design was fired for his temerity. The senior leadership wouldn't listen. In commercial aviation, Douglas Aircraft, with its DC series, had a major lead over Boeing immediately after World War II. Douglas was so focused on filling all of its orders for the propeller-powered DC-7 that it failed to move quickly enough to jet engines. Boeing built the jet-powered 707 on speculation, without a single customer order in hand, and never looked back. Douglas is now part of Boeing. It doesn't do any good to be receptive to bad news if you can't get bad news up through your organization and then do something about it in a hurry. Today's digital technology can ensure that you get the news and that you can put your organization into action fast. How fast a company can respond to an emergency is a measure of its corporate reflexes. People in the organization will feel lousy and threatened by bad news, but that's okay as long as they feel it as a group. As an active leadership, I created a sense of crisis about the Internet in 1994 and 1995. Not to leave people paralyzed or unhappy, but to excite them to action. The leader needs to create an environment in which people can analyze the situation and develop a good response. I like good news as much as the next person, but it also puts me in a skeptical frame of mind. I wonder what bad news I'm not hearing. When somebody sends me an email about an account we've won, I always think, there are a lot of accounts nobody has sent email about. Does that mean we've lost all of those? This reaction may seem unwarranted, but I've found there's a psychological impulse in people to send good news when there's bad news brewing. It's as if they want to lessen the shock. A good email system ensures that bad news can travel fast, but your people have to be willing to send you the news. You have to be consistently receptive to bad news, and then you have to act on it. Sometimes I think my most important job as a CEO is to listen for bad news. If you don't act on it, your people will eventually stop bringing bad news to your attention. And that's the beginning of the end. In 3 years, every product my company makes will be obsolete. The only question is whether we'll make them obsolete or somebody else will. In the next 10 years, if Microsoft remains a leader, we'll have had to weather at least 3 major crises. That's why we've always got to do better. Ask anybody who's ever worked at Microsoft, and they'll tell you that if there's one cultural quality we have, it's that we always see ourselves as an underdog. I see us as an underdog today, just as I've seen us as an underdog every day for the last 20 years. If we don't maintain that perspective, some competitor will eat our lunch. I insist that we stay on top of the news, as well as pursue longer-term developments on the research front, and that we use bad news to drive us to put innovative new features into our products. One day, somebody will catch us napping. One day, an eager upstart will put Microsoft out of business. I just hope it's 50 years from now, not 2 or 5. Once you embrace unpleasant news not as a negative, but as evidence of a need for change, you aren't defeated by it. You're learning from it. It's all in how you approach failures, and believe me, we know a lot about failures at Microsoft. Back in the 1980s, our multi-plan spreadsheet product couldn't make any headway against Lotus 1-2-3. We spent the last half of the 1980s working on a database called Omega before we finally abandoned the project in 1990. We based our long-term operating system strategy on jointly building OS 2 with IBM. But that project came to an end in 1992 after we'd sunk hundreds of millions of dollars and countless hours of developer time into it. In the early 1990s, we had to can our Newton-like personal digital assistant because the technology wasn't good enough. In 1993, we had a project we thought would revolutionize office machines such as copiers and faxes called Microsoft at Work, but it never worked. In the mid-1990s, our TV-style internet shows on MSN were a flop. The weight of all of our failures could make me too depressed to come into work. Instead, I'm excited about the challenges and by how we can use today's bad news to help solve tomorrow's problems. What we learned in our multi-plan spreadsheet effort helped us develop Microsoft Excel, the most advanced graphical spreadsheet when it came to market in 1985, and it still leads the competition. A lot of what we learned from the Omega database project paid off several years later, when we shipped Microsoft Access, which became the most popular desktop database. That modern, built-from-scratch, world-class operating system, initially intended to be OS 2 version 3.0, became Windows NT instead. Our early experiences with small devices and office form factors helped us understand the technical requirements for a growing market we now serve with our Windows CE operating system. And our internet media investments taught us that our customers thought our role on the internet should be as a provider of practical, software-intensive products such as Microsoft Expedia, Travel, Investor, Finance, and Sidewalk, Leisure. Learning from mistakes and constantly improving products is a key in all successful companies. Listening to customers is a big part of that effort. You have to study what customers say about their problems with your products and stay tuned in to what they want, extrapolating from leading-edge buyers to predict future requirements. In software, customers always want more. If you improve software reliability, customers say, great, but what about scalability? If you improve scalability, they want more integration. Our customers are always upping the ante, as they should. Listening to the customers means hearing their complaints about current product shortcomings. But getting bad news from customers passed all the way to the product design groups is surprisingly hard to do. Most companies have an inefficient chain of people and paper between customers and the people who can make major improvements. When the customer data finally reaches the product design group, it often isn't easy for the team to digest its significance and prioritize it accordingly. All of the delays taken together mean that improvements don't happen as fast as they should. I recommend the following approach to integrating customer complaints and wish lists into product and service development. Focus on your most unhappy customers. Use technology to gather rich information on their unhappy experiences with your product and to find out what they want you to put into the product. Use technology to drive the news to the right people in a hurry. If you do these three things, you'll turn those draining bad news experiences into an exhilarating process of improving your product or service. Unhappy customers are always a concern. They're also your greatest opportunity. Adopting a learning posture rather than a negative defensive posture can make customer complaints your best source of significant quality improvements. Adopting the right technology will give you the power to capture and convert complaints into better products and services fast. Hotels and airlines usually offer a satisfaction guarantee. If you're unhappy with the company's service, you receive a discount or an upgrade that's good the next time. The satisfaction guarantee is actually a sales tool designed to get you to come back. A radically different approach comes from Promise Hotels based in Memphis, Tennessee. Promise, which generated $5 billion in revenue in 1997, has a family of hotels. The best known are the Hampton Inns, Embassy Suites, and Doubletree Inns. Promise was the first hotel chain to guarantee no charge for your current visit if you have any complaint about your stay. And any Promise employee can make good on that guarantee. A front desk clerk, a maid, a maintenance engineer, anybody. For obvious reasons, customers love the Promise Guarantee. Debbie Fields, president and chief executive officer of Mrs. Fields, the chain of cookie and baked goods stores, stayed at a Hampton Inn one time and mentioned a